I'm Brian Karam, and I've spent decades covering politics. Now I'm taking you behind the scenes, one interview at a time.
Join us as each week Brian confronts the issues that matter, posing the questions you wish you could ask. No filter, no agenda, just the truth.
We're not here for sound bites. We're here for substance. Join me, Brian Karam, every week as we cut through the noise and get straight to it. This is Just Ask the Question, where curiosity will lead us to the facts.
Subscribe now on your favorite podcast platform. And remember, when you want answers, all you have to do is just ask the question.
Welcome to Care Talk Live, a weekly American healthcare policy show and podcast where we explain how healthcare works or doesn't work and get you answers. I'm Laura Packard, cancer survivor and healthcare advocate, here to help you. Be sure to subscribe to my channel or podcast wherever you get your podcasts to get future Care Talk shows. Whether you're a cancer patient, caregiver, or healthcare activist, you have more power than you think. Molly shares ACS CAN's proven strategies for turning personal healthcare stories into legislative action, from scheduling meetings with your representatives to delivering a message that actually moves the needle. So welcome to our guest, Molly Montague, a government relations director at American Cancer Society Cancer Action Network. Welcome, Molly.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
So for all our audience listening at home, what's the first thing they should know when trying to contact their legislators?
Yeah, well, first off, state legislators are their sort of own animal. When we think about lawmakers, we often think of people up on Capitol Hill in DC in suits, a little intimidating. But your state lawmakers especially are everyday people. They are folks in your community that are responsible and beholden to you as their constituents. So you have every right to talk to them, to tell them your experience, and to share your story, especially when it comes to your experience with healthcare as a patient. Lawmakers are trying to legislate on so many different issues, transportation, public safety, healthcare, and they may be an expert in one or two of those, but they're certainly not a deep level expert or may have the personal experiences necessary to really understand and address an issue. And that's where patients come in and why it's so needed to have patient advocacy. So if somebody wants to reach out and schedule a meeting with their lawmaker, the first thing I would say is know your timing. There's different times of the year, depending on where you are and what you're trying to reach out to. If you have an issue close to your heart, and it's a pretty general one, you don't have a specific bill, piece of legislation, or policy in mind that you want to push, it's good to reach out more during the summer months, so May to September, really regardless of whatever state you're in. Here in Virginia and in much of the South, we have pretty short sessions that run really just January to mid to late spring, but some states will have year-round legislatures, but generally they'll take a break in the summer. And that's a good time for you to be able to reach out and say, this is an issue that I've been facing. This is what this looks like. And here's a potential solution that I think might work. And I'd love to know Senator so-and-so, Delegate so-and-so, Representative so-and-so, what you're going to do about it. Now, if you do have a specific piece of legislation, you can reach out starting in December, heading into that busy legislative season about that piece of legislation more specifically, because that's when they'll be focused on it. And that's when they'll be really taking public comment about it. And when you might get to participate in an advocacy day, like the ones we do at the Cancer Action Network, our Cancer Action Days.
Great. So it sounds like if you have more of a general issue or idea, a way to make healthcare in your state better or something that needs to be fixed, the best time for a more general reach out is in the summer when they're not in session. But if you have a specific bill, you should be contacting your legislators while they are actually in the Capitol passing laws.
Yes, exactly.
What's the best way for to reach out to your legislator for them to take you seriously? Like if you want to meet with your legislator, is it as simple as picking up the phone or sending an email and saying, I want to meet with you?
It can be. It does depend a little bit on the personality of your state. I would say some states are a little more casual than others. I'm looking at you, Montana. But generally, you want to write a formal email or pick up the phone and do a call. If you pick up the phone or you send an email, you're likely the first person you're going to come into contact with is a staff member of some kind. And it's a misconception that lawmakers have lots of money in their offices and they have lots of things. In most states, a state lawmaker actually only has one, maybe two staff members, sometimes a whole team of folks in the states that have those year-round legislatures. But often there's one person trying to manage constituent calls, policy, communications, while the member is also trying to be an elected official and hold down a full-time job in most states that are part-time legislatures. So know that if you get staff, they are a very important person. They are somebody you should treat with respect and certainly talk to as though they know very much about the issues because they are the neck that turns the head in many cases. So pick up the phone, write an email, you know, address it very, very professionally. You want to say, you know, dear senator, dear delegate, their last name, and then introduce yourself, explain where you're from, that you're from their district. If you've ever met them or run into them, you might want to note that. And then paint your story. And this can be very brief. You don't want to really have a super long conversation on the phone, right? You're trying to get a meeting with them. And similarly, you don't want to say everything in an email. So just, you know, I've been experiencing these issues. I've been witness to these problems. I think that there's potential solutions here. I'd love to have a chance to have a conversation with you as my senator, delegate, representative, about what that may look like in the upcoming session. You can offer some times that work for you. That'll make their scheduler's life easier. And of course, say that you have flexibility for their schedule. The only other thing I will say is I, having been a staffer myself and having, you know, befriended many staffers, the more you can do to make their life easier. So giving them more information, if you do have a policy or if there are other people you've had this conversation with, perhaps there's some friends or even a coalition or a local nonprofit who's helped you out, being able to reference that, you know, you've already done some digging, you've already looked at what some of these solutions might be, can be a bit helpful because it means that they're not looking to just solve one person's problem because that's a constituent service issue. They're looking to solve a systemic problem, which is more of a legislation policy issue.
So going back to what you were saying originally, it works different in state legislatures than in Congress. In Congress, you would never hope to just pick up the phone and schedule a meeting with your U.S. representative or your U.S. senator, but you could actually talk to your state senator just by reaching out?
Yes, you really can. As a matter of fact, if you come down to your state capitol during session, you might very well walk into their office and catch them in between meetings and things. They're going to be very busy, but they might be there and you might get to talk to them. If you're home, you know, in the summer during 4th of July parades or cookouts or whatever, they likely will make an appearance there as well. So there's plenty of moments to really interact with these level of legislators, as well as your local lawmakers as well, your mayors, your city council members, et cetera.
For somebody that's never done this kind of thing before, how would you explain the difference between what you can actually get done in your state versus in Congress? Because, you know, people default to thinking about Congress does all the things. What are some things that a state legislature could do to make your healthcare better?
Yeah, it's a great question because often our civics education is very limited to the federal level and we only know really what Congress does. The good news is that most states, policy structure is very similar in terms of executive, judiciary, legislative, right? The federal level really manages down to the states. It controls certain funding that states get. And there are things that are federal jurisdiction when it comes to certain determinations made about healthcare, made about taxes, made about business negotiations, things like that. But at the state level, states often run their own healthcare marketplace. They decide how funds are distributed. They run their Medicaid programs. They can help address the cost of prescription medications. They can deal with how things are taxed at a state and local level. The states often speak down to the localities. Does depend a bit on your state, what the, what that sort of language looks like, and what they're allowed to do. But when we think about healthcare more broadly, there's a lot happening at the state level right now, particularly because Congress has been a little slow to act on some big issues. And so we're seeing states take big steps to try to meet a growing gap in terms of access to healthcare, cost of healthcare, and access to, you know, specific treatments and the affordability of all of that.
So can you give some examples of things that you're working on or have worked on in Virginia so people can get a sense of what your state legislature could actually do?
Sure. And I'm so grateful that you were there to help us testify this year for a bill that we have successfully sent to Governor Spanberger's desk and are waiting for her to sign it into law, which is sort of the final step in the bill becomes a law process. This bill would help cap prescription medication costs so that that cost of the specialty medication that many cancer patients need to stay alive would be smoothed out over the course of their plan that year. Right now, many health plans don't offer a plan structure that is copay based. They only offer coinsurance. So that means that you might be paying 10% of a very expensive medication on the first day of the month and hit your out-of-pocket cost on the very first day, which many people cannot afford. And they will withgo their medication because they cannot afford that, versus being able to choose a plan that allows them to budget. They say, okay, I know this medication is not going to go above $350 every month rather than hitting $10,000 out of the gate. And they can plan that. So this bill mandates that all the health plans have at least one offering that is copay based and those copays are capped. So depending on the metal level, they have different caps. And like I said, that we had advocates come in, tell their story, very personal stories about how the cost of their medication or medication of their loved ones was prohibiting continued care, or where they were in a position to be able to afford their care. But if they had not been able to, they would have had to discontinue care. We had folks at public hearings, which are in some states available remotely as well. So you don't have to come to your state capital. And we also had folks writing in who are on our Cancer Action Network listserv, and we send out a call to action saying, hey, we need you to contact your lawmaker and tell them this matters to you. And they take that action. And that gives me on the ground something to be able to follow up on as well.
So for most people, coming up with an idea and contacting your legislator, perhaps they will think it's also a good idea and they'll run with it. But people might have more success reaching out to an organization like ACS CAN. Would you suggest that people, you know, find an organization that represents people with similar interests to them as a place to start?
I think that's a really good place to start. Not only will it help you maybe get training or friends who are trying to do something similar and have a community, but they also can help find all those resources, all that information, and have answers to the questions that lawmakers at some point in that process are going to want to know. What have other states done on this? You know, how much is this going to cost? Has this been introduced in the past? Now, you can go find all that information, but usually these organizations have already done that work and will have that information available. What's really important and what the organizations like ours need are the patient voices. We need the experiences. We need the stories communicated to the lawmakers. And that's because we can go in there and I can talk about the capped copays and the numbers and words like insurance and coinsurance and, you know, tax rates. That they hear that day in and day out. What they don't hear is a little old woman who's talking about her brother nearly dying because he can't afford his medication and she's just barely able to afford hers. And I can then amplify that story and connect it to the policy. But we need those stories because they humanize a potentially otherwise very dry policy that's actually about solving a problem for very real people. A very real problem that's life or death in many cases. And I will say just very briefly, if you need a quick formula to come up with your story, I would start with painting a picture of the problem through a narrative, a short one, two or three sentences. Then describe what needs change. Pinpoint something specific within that story that if it changed, it would have changed the ending of that story, and describe that. Then identify whatever other measures you may have taken or tried to address this problem, and describe the potential impact of the proposed change. If this proposed change happened, this would be the transformational impact. This wouldn't happen to somebody else. I would have better access to this, whatever the actual potential impact of that is. And then make an ask. If the ask is a meeting, I would really love to talk more about this with you. Do you have time sometime in July? Or I noticed that bill number blah, blah, blah is addressing this, and I would like to know where you stand on this bill. And I ask that you support it or you oppose it, et cetera. Make an ask. And ideally, if they don't come back to you, follow up with them on it.
Thanks. Any last thoughts for our audience on how to contact their legislator?
No, only it's much easier than you think. You can Google their name. You will get an email address and a phone number. If you live in Virginia, look up VPAP, the Virginia Public Access Project. They collect all that information as well. Other states have similar databases where you can go and get campaign staff information and information like that. And I'll just end by saying your voices are so important. I would not be here doing this work if it wasn't for the patient experiences that step forward and say we need change. So please continue to show up, to learn, to share your voice, to highlight the problems so that we can create the systemic change and a brighter future for all of us.
Thank you, Molly. And a reminder to everyone that we have free or low-cost healthcare resources available on our website at healthcarevoices.org/caretalk. So check it out. Please text or call in your health insurance and healthcare questions at 202-838-6837, and we'll answer them in future episodes. And now our experts will answer your health insurance questions. So welcome to Louise Norris, Health Insurance and Healthcare Reform Analyst at healthinsurance.org, and Diane Archer, Founder and President of Just Care USA. So let's start with Diane, because the Trump administration just made some changes that weaken the Medicare Advantage star rating system, making it easier for Medicare Advantage plans to get 4 or 5 star ratings, and giving a big financial boost to the insurers who are already overpaid. So tell us, what are these changes and how will they affect patients?
Great question. So just by way of background, the government has this 5-star rating system for Medicare Advantage plans, which a lot of people with Medicare rely on to help choose their Medicare Advantage plan. And I guess to begin, I should just say they're nothing like star ratings on hotels or restaurants. So beware. I've always said that the star ratings are a farce because they don't help you to know whether a particular Medicare Advantage plan will meet your care needs. At best, you know, to avoid the plans with 1, 2, and 3 stars. So the Trump administration's new rule means that a lot of the MA plans with 1, 2, and 3 stars are now going to have 4 or 5 stars, making it even harder to avoid the worst quality Medicare Advantage plans. So now, just to be clear, even joining a Medicare Advantage plans with 4 and 5 stars leaves you gambling with your health and possibly with your life, because the stars don't focus on critical metrics. But each Medicare Advantage plan is different in 3 significant ways when it comes to your health. Their networks, which providers you can see that are, you know, will be covered by your plan, which hospitals and doctors, their prior authorization rules, what rules they have for whether you can get care and when without their approval, or whether you need their approval, and also their denial rates. How frequently do they second guess your treating physician, overrule that treating physician, and deny you the care your treating physician says you need? On the issue of networks, it's really impossible to know whether the doctors you want to see in a given Medicare Advantage plan will be in network or out when you need to see them. There is a Medicare Advantage provider directory, and you can look at it, but it's too often wrong and inaccurate. So if you're choosing based on the doctors and hospitals in that network, double check with those doctors and hospitals before you join. But even if they say they are a network today, in a few months, they can leave the network. So you can never be sure. On prior authorization rules, again, some Medicare Advantage insurers have a ton of those rules, making it really hard for you to get care quickly when you most need it. And others have fewer rules, but you have absolutely no idea which ones will make you wait a long time to get your cancer care and which ones will allow you to get that care as quickly as possible. Finally, on denial rates, too often Medicare Advantage plans deny care inappropriately. Some deny care 1 in 5 times. I mean, and we just have no clue which ones are denying care inappropriately at high rates and which aren't. And that's why even choosing a 4 or 5-star plan is a gamble. So what is the Trump administration doing? Instead of helping you to understand differences among Medicare Advantage plans when it comes to networks, prior authorization rules, and denial rates, it's eliminating about 10 of the metrics that are used to give these plans 3, 4, and 5-star ratings and 1 and 2-star ratings. And that makes it even easier for these plans to have better ratings. So this means more MA plans will have 4 and 5 stars, and more 4 and 5-star plans will be lower quality than in the past, and you still will be gambling with your health and your life in a 4 and 5-star plan. Not a great situation for people enrolling in Medicare Advantage.
Thank you, Diane. And next we have a question from Robin on Facebook, who said that I had radiation for cancer and I went to an in-network provider. Then when the bill was submitted, it was not paid as out of network. Sometime during my treatment, the radiation place went out of network and the place got approval before my treatment. Now I have a $25,000 bill. Louise, what should Robin do?
So the No Surprises Act, which took effect in 2022, has a provision in it to address exactly this sort of situation where it's for specifically for people who are dealing with a complex or serious health condition, which obviously cancer would qualify. If you are in the middle of treatment and the provider, in this case, the radiation center, goes out of network for reasons other than failing to meet quality standards or fraud. So it's just a run-of-the-mill, you know, going out of network for other reasons. First of all, the facility has to notify you that they are going out of network and then give you an option to get up to 90 days of continuity of care where you can continue to basically be treated as if you're in network for up to 90 days. So it applies to situations like an ongoing pregnancy, radiation, chemotherapy, something like that, gives you basically 90 days of in-network care even after the facility or provider has gone out of network. It sounds like in this case maybe the patient didn't get notified, which that would be the facility had the obligation to provide that notification. And then it's possible that maybe there was a miscommunication between the facility and the plan, or the patient didn't realize what their rights were. At this point, my recommendation would be to call the No Surprises Act help desk. CMS set this up. It's an 800 number. The phone number is 1-800-985-3059. Again, that's 1-800-985-3059. That's the federal government's No Surprises Act help desk, where you can call in and explain the situation that has happened and why you think there was a breach of the No Surprises Act requirements, and they can start facilitating a resolution. You can also contact your state insurance department. Your mileage will vary there in terms of how much they can help, because it does depend on the type of insurance you have. But your state insurance department is local. They're right there in your state, and they may be able to facilitate a resolution faster or easier. Each state has its own insurance department. You can look that up and get a phone number for your state.
Thank you, Louise. Next for Diane, why can't you switch out of Medicare Advantage to traditional network to traditional Medicare outside of open enrollment when you need a lot of care?
So the government has a lot of rules about switching in and out and doesn't want people moving around too much for all kinds of reasons. But I want to start by just saying that during the annual fall open enrollment period, you have the ability to go from Medicare Advantage to traditional Medicare. And also between January and March, in those 3 months, you can move easily into traditional Medicare from Medicare Advantage. There are also special enrollment periods for people, for example, who are moving outside of their current area to another area. They have the opportunity to enroll in traditional Medicare. And then there are those who, for reasons that are hard to go into detail on, but leave them without Medicare Advantage coverage, they are automatically in traditional Medicare. So for example, if you don't pay your Medicare Advantage premium, the Medicare Advantage plan can terminate you, but you won't be without coverage. You'll be in traditional Medicare. The issue, and this is the serious issue for anybody who's in Medicare Advantage and anybody who wants to be in traditional Medicare, is that traditional Medicare doesn't have an out-of-pocket limit, meaning that there's no cap on how much you will pay out of pocket if you are in traditional Medicare and needing a lot of care. You will be paying 20% of Medicare's approved rate for all of your Part B physician services, outpatient services, and then coinsurance and deductibles for your hospital care. So your costs can be sky high. Right now, you need supplemental coverage, and that is expensive, and often the insurers don't have to sell it to you. So a lot of people do not have a meaningful choice of traditional Medicare, even when they can join it, because the costs are just prohibitively high. In addition, if you're moving into traditional Medicare, you're going to need Part D prescription drug coverage, and you can only get that at certain times in certain instances. So there's a lot of complexity there. A lot depends on your state's rules about what you're entitled to in terms of coverage, but a lot turns on how much you can afford to spend. So bottom line is, traditional Medicare should be a meaningful choice for anybody who wants to go into it, especially when Medicare Advantage plans are not meeting people's needs, not covering the care they need when they need it. And we are educating members of Congress, and they are looking into now putting an out-of-pocket limit into traditional Medicare, which will make it much easier for people to move into it. And if you want to be in traditional Medicare because your Medicare Advantage plan is not meeting your needs, I would argue that you should do exactly what you have just learned about in terms of speaking to your members of Congress. So yes, you can go and speak to your state legislators about a lot of healthcare issues, but you can also reach out to your congresspeople. They probably won't meet with you, but their staff will. And if you can go to their staff in their district offices and you can explain to them your story, they will hear your story. And if there's any way that they can help you, they will. And if there's any way you can get them to hear the need for a supplemental, for an out-of-pocket cap in traditional Medicare so you don't need supplemental coverage, let them know this is critically important so that you have a meaningful choice of traditional Medicare.
Thank you, Diane. This is a question from Piranha on Reddit, who says, why does dental insurance feel almost useless for actual treatment? It feels like dental insurance is great for cleanings and basic stuff, but the moment you need something expensive, like crowns, root canals, implants, you hit a low annual maximum and suddenly you're paying thousands out of pocket anyway. I've seen plans that cap at just $1,000 or $2,000 a year, which barely covers one procedure. So what are people doing in real life when they need bigger dental work? Louise?
Yeah, this is an unfortunate reality. The Affordable Care Act did make pediatric dental an essential health benefit, which means in the individual and small group market, you can't have, for plans that are sold within the health insurance marketplace, there can't be a benefit cap on kids' dental work, but that does not apply to adults. And most of the time when you're needing things like implants and crowns and dentures, it's adults. It is the vast majority of adult dental plans do have a benefit cap somewhere in the range of $1,000 to maybe $2,500 a year, which, as you pointed out, is not going to go very far if you do start needing extensive dental care. And a lot of plans will fully exclude things like dentures and implants. Even if you could get one implant covered, the plan might simply not cover it at all. So you can, depending on the situation, some people will work with their dental provider to try to spread the care they need over a couple of years in order, you know, and get part of it at the end of one plan year and part of it at the beginning of another plan year, depending on how much of an emergency the situation is. Obviously, if you're in tremendous pain, that's not going to work. But if not, maybe they can, you know, do part of it and then wait till the next plan year begins and do the next part. Depending on where you live and how much you earn, you might be eligible for a dental clinic that works on a sliding fee scale. There are also dental schools where you can get some procedures done at a lower cost. But yeah, this is just an issue where people do have to sort of cobble together the best they can, because there really are not any regulations requiring any sort of better dental coverage. And this really hasn't changed. Like, you know, I've been in this industry well over 20 years, and the dental plan benefit caps are still the same as they were back then. So it's as dental prices have increased, the benefit caps on the policies really have not increased. So this is an issue where you can reach out to your lawmakers, talk about the issue, the fact that you know, dental care is unaffordable, but it is an unfortunate reality of the way things currently are.
Thank you, Louise. And for those that are listening that are self-employed, or maybe you're a gig worker or freelancer and you pay your taxes as you have self-employment income, one of the reasons why I got dental insurance, it's about the same as the cost of actually seeing the dentist for regular checkups. But the reason why I got dental insurance was to be able to deduct that on my taxes for self-employment income. So that's one case where if it works out to be about the same cost, it might make sense if you're a gig worker, freelancer, again, or self-employed.
Absolutely. And sometimes people say that the reason they get in and go to the dentist twice a year for their cleanings and checkups is because they have insurance that pays for that part of it. So if that's the thing that's going to get you in there and get your routine care done, even if you end up breaking even on cost overall, then that can be another reason to have dental insurance, just because it gets you in for that visit.
Absolutely. So thank you, everyone, for joining us to learn more about how to talk to your legislators about healthcare. Be sure to check out more free or low-cost healthcare resources on our website at healthcarevoices.org/caretalk. Please text or call in your health insurance and healthcare questions at 202-838-6837, and we'll answer them in future episodes. We are going on spring break. We will be back in May. Be sure to subscribe to my channel or podcast, wherever you get your podcasts, to get the next episode in May. My name is Laura Packard, and this is Care Talk.
It's Sunday morning, and that wonderfully relaxed feeling of a long, lazy day lingers in the air. If you want to make the moment last, may I suggest the perfect solution? The Martin Sheen Podcast. Join me, your host, Martin Sheen, for beautifully crafted 20-minute programs filled with never-before-heard stories of my life, along with personal reflections and poetry that inspires. The Martin Sheen Podcast is the perfect Sunday refresh, a chance to take a deep breath, relax, and know that the stress of Monday may be just around the corner, but not here, not now. So make this your weekly moment of calm as we explore faith, hope, love, and what it means to be human. And know this, this journey is ever unfolding as I invite you to see what's next with me, Martin Sheen, and thank you.